Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Popcorn Science. In this podcast, we take a critical look at the science portrayed in our favorite movies and television shows. I'm one of your hosts, Dr. Catherine Nisch. I'm a professor of earth sciences, a planetary geologist, and a fan of pop culture.
And I'm Dr. John Moores, a professor of space engineering at York University, a planetary atmospheric scientist, and a speculative fiction nerd.
This week was my choice, and this was actually something that was requested by one of our fans, who also happens to be my sister, and that is the 1998 movie Deep Impact. For those of you who weren't alive in 1998, it was the summer of the killer asteroid movie. So both this movie and Armageddon came out within 2 months of each other, and they both focused on an asteroid on its way to harm the Earth in a very devastating way. Deep Impact starts in 1998 with a high school student who discovers a comet that's later confirmed to be on a collision course with Earth. The government keeps it a secret for about a year while they attempt to build a spacecraft to destroy the comet, but the secret is eventually discovered by a reporter, forcing the President of the United States to break the news about a year before the comet is set to impact the Earth.
There was a remote possibility that the comet was on a path that could bring it into direct contact with the Earth. Now, we get hit all the time by rocks and meteors, some of them the size of cars, some no bigger than your hand. But the comet we discovered is the size of New York City, from the north side of Central Park to the Battery, about 7 miles long. Put another way, this comet is larger than Mount Everest.
Their initial attempt to destroy the comet fails, so a lottery is set up to house a million lucky people who will survive in an underground bunker. But a last-minute gamble by the astronauts does destroy the bigger half of the comet, but unfortunately, a smaller piece hits the Atlantic, killing millions in the resulting tsunami. This was quite a summer. People were obsessed with asteroids hitting the Earth for some reason. I actually remember Armageddon better than Deep Impact, even though Deep Impact came out first. So
same
Deep Impact,
here, same here.
Yeah, there was a lot of tie-ins with Aerosmith. I actually happened to be at Kennedy Space Center in June of 1998, and I remember seeing like huge stadium kind of set up for a concert. I think they were promoting the movie that came out July 1st, 1998. They played the song over and over on the radio, this Aerosmith song. What is it called? Don't want to close my eyes. You know that one?
Yeah. I remember the lines, but I forget the name.
I forget the name as well. It was very popular. They played it a lot on the radio. But Deep Impact actually came out in May, as you'll come to find out. I think both John and I think it is the better movie. For that reason, and because my sister specifically requested it, we decided to do Deep Impact rather than Armageddon. Maybe we'll get to Armageddon at some later point. But today's focus is on Deep Impact. I do love a good 90s movie. I'm ready to jump in here. John, what is your history with these disaster asteroid movies?
Well, I can tell you, even in St. John's, I feel like Armageddon was the bigger of the two movies. It had the song. It had Bruce Willis. It had Michael Bay, King of Disaster. And it had that energy, I think, of coming out right on, like you say, the start of July, you know, that sort of peak in those days of the summer movie season. But at the same time, you're right. I don't think even at the start, people really thought of it as the thinking person's movie. It was all testosterone and explosions and really hyped up that less realistic, more sensational side of the end of the Earth, whereas Deep Impact takes a very different tack, I think. And I'm sure we'll get to that. We did, by the way, folks, manage to come up with some good science gripes here, even though this is definitely one of the better movies, I would say, pre the core. So even before that wonderful thing, we still have a movie that really, I think, does a good job getting things right. But I'm getting ahead of myself here. We always start with the science gripes. Why don't we just get started with that?
Just jump right in. Why don't we start with the opening scene of this movie? So this movie starts with this group of people in a field in Richmond, Virginia, all looking through telescopes. We find out it's a high school astronomy club, which includes Elijah Wood, who would later go on to extreme fame with Lord of the Rings series. And they're all looking at stars and they're having a great time. But there are a few things in this scene that were a bit jarring. You can hear people talking in the background, and very clearly somebody says Alpha Centauri. And I don't know why they said that, because Alpha Centauri is not a star that you can see from Virginia. It's well known as sort of of a southern hemisphere star. I have seen it the few times I've been to the southern hemisphere. It's interesting because it's the closest star to Earth. Well, technically Proxima Centauri, but it's a triple system, right, John? I think there's three stars in that system.
That sounds about right to me.
There's a number of stars in that system, but it is the closest one to the sun, only about 4 light years away. But you can't see it from Virginia. I don't know why they were talking about it. And these high school students also seem very well versed in their knowledge of the names of stars. I was in a high school astronomy club. I have a degree in astronomy. I know the names of very few stars in the sky. You know, I could maybe point out Sirius and Betelgeuse, and that's about it. I don't know, John, am I the anomaly here? Do you know the names of all the stars in the sky?
No, I don't think that. I mean, I certainly don't know the names of all the stars in the sky, but in working with the observatory here at York, there are definitely some students who really do. I think it's maybe the difference between an enthusiast and a professional, because I feel like, you know, like we're both professional planetary scientists, right? When was the last time you looked at a planet through a telescope?
Great question. I don't know. Not recently.
Exactly. For us, I think it's a little bit different. Whereas, you know, when I talk to the RASC, when I talk to the kids who work at the observatory, my apologies to the undergraduates, you get this impression that, you know, if I asked them that question, it would be like last night. Mm-hmm. So I wonder if maybe that's what they're trying to do here, to imply that these kids are enthusiasts rather than folks that have been dragged out by their teacher.
Right, right. Sure. I can't imagine a high school student would name every star in the Big Dipper. It was just hard to believe for me. The point here is they discover a comet during this observing session, and I can't imagine that a high school student would know that there is a star, quoting marks, that's out of place in the field of view, having memorized star charts. That seemed a little hard to believe to me.
Yeah, and their teacher's not that great because he confuses it for a satellite, as you point out.
Yeah, he's like, oh, maybe it's just a satellite. But if it was a satellite, it would be zipping across your tiny field of view in your telescope, and it would disappear immediately, right? This is clearly not a satellite. It is much farther from the Earth. So I don't know why the teacher suggested that. Maybe he's like the gym teacher who's just helping out with the astronomy club one night. I don't know. No shade to gym teachers. I really enjoyed physical education, but this teacher didn't seem to know what he was talking about. And then as you point out too, like they must be looking through a tiny field of view, right? And yet they're seeing all these stars, which seemed kind of hard to believe.
Yeah, especially in a very light polluted area over there in Richmond, Virginia. And they talk at one point about how you can see what turns out to be the comet 10 degrees away from another star, and it's both in the same field of view. There is very few astronomical instruments that can see that wide of a field of view. An interesting oversight with some of this stuff.
Yeah, yeah. And then we cut over to Arizona. I guess they have a colleague that they work with at the Adrian Peak Observatory, which, so John and I both lived in Tucson for many years, and there is quite a famous observatory near Tucson called Kitt Peak Observatory, and I don't know why they just didn't call it Kitt Peak and they made up this fictional Adrian Peak Observatory. Maybe they couldn't get the rights to using the name. It's clearly a stand-in for Kitt Peak, though. This is an actual observatory. I mean, it looked like an observatory. It's in California, the Mount Wilson Observatory in Pasadena. So that seemed legit. I don't know. I've been to Kitt Peak. I don't know why they just didn't go with that. A minor quibble, I will say. But then we see this astronomer finding the comet. It's an actual picture of a comet. I think we'll get to that later. So that was good. But then he does this weird trajectory calculation from a single observation and determines that it's going to hit the Earth. And this is not correct, right? You need more than one observation to tell whether or not if an object is going to hit the Earth. You can't extrapolate an orbit from one data point.
Oh, yeah. And these kinds of instruments, they're usually pretty tightly booked. So it's strange that this person is almost like showing up at work and trying to figure out, oh, what am I going to do today with this giant piece of technology? And flips through, you know, this report that he got from a high school student, said, I'll have a look at this thing. Normally, you have to apply for telescope funding. This stuff is very highly scheduled. So that struck me as a little bit odd. And I think you noticed the fact that he was actually out in the same room with the telescope as opposed to being in a separate control room.
Yeah, I've never been to Mount Wilson, so maybe this is how they do it there. But most telescopes I've been to, the control room is actually somewhere else inside the building, separated from the telescope itself. Because, you know, you want to keep the thermal conditions within the telescope pretty constant. Basically, hot air can act as a lens, and so you don't want a bunch of hot air in your observatory messing with the optics. So typically, control rooms are outside the main telescope area. And there's like a window, and you can see into it from there.
It's entertaining, though, because I feel like this is far enough back that maybe the operation was a little bit different, but not this different. One of my favorite stories is actually from Mount Palomar, which was the biggest observatory in the world before space exploration, and hearing about astronomers changing out the photographic plates in the prime focus of the telescope and enjoying putting their face in the prime focus. Apparently it was an experience.
Yeah, yeah. Another thing you see in movies a lot is people will be at these giant telescopes, like looking through an eyepiece, which is not something that has happened in decades. We just put cameras at the focal plane and take pictures and then analyze them later. I think they were doing that at least in this movie. So that was good. He wasn't just looking through the eyepiece of this giant telescope. So they make this discovery. Unfortunately, he immediately gets killed racing down the mountain to, I don't know why he was racing down the mountain. Like, he could have just used his cell phone to call from the telescope. So the internet wasn't working. So he's like, oh no, I can't get through. But A, why does he need to tell somebody immediately when this thing is going to hit in 2 years? Why can't he make a phone call? Why is he racing down the mountain? Why is there a truck coming up the mountain? Typically, these observatories are pretty remote. Like, you wouldn't just have a trucker going up to a telescope for no reason. So that scene was absurd.
Contrived?
Contrived. Yes, that's a good word. I mean, poor Wolf, he did die. So rest in peace. That whole thing seemed kind of crazy. And then the whole thing exploded, right? So who eventually found out about this comet, right? Because he wasn't able to tell anybody about it. Maybe the internet kicked in later and his email got sent out. I don't know.
Well, there's a bit of a bait and switch there, right? By the way, kudos, our first exploding car in a movie. This is something that's always done badly in every movie, not just movies that try to get the science right. But we're sort of led to believe from that scene that, you know, oh, the data is lost. The world is going to be in trouble. And we find out later that, you know, oh, it's okay. Somehow the government got that disc. Somehow the government took it seriously, which is kind of surprising because it really is set up to make you think that, oh no, this information is lost.
Yeah, it
just
was
just because he's mad at his pop server.
Right. It was a weird jump cut because you jump cut a year in the future and you think nobody's going to know about this. And, you know, the comet is just hurtling closer and closer to Earth, which A, wouldn't happen because somebody else would discover it, right? So the whole thing was just strange. But John, I had the same impression. I thought, oh, they're going to cut and nobody's going to know about it. And then they're going to have to scramble to destroy this thing with a shortened timeline. But that didn't happen. Somehow they found out about it. And then somehow they kept it secret from the entire world, which is also hard to believe. Because again, there's lots of astronomers with lots of telescopes looking up at the sky. Surely somebody else would have spotted it in the meantime, especially as it gets closer and closer to Earth and brighter and brighter. So that was hard to believe that only this one, you know, astronomer in the United States and no one else was able to find it.
Exactly. I mean, by this point, it is already visible in fairly basic backyard astronomer kind of equipment. And some of those people do have impressive instruments, but from what we see in the movie, these are not those. It must have already been fairly bright. Why don't we jump over to the comet itself? Because I feel like the depiction of that is probably where you and I had the most cringing.
Which part of that, John?
Oh, just the visit that their spacecraft called the Messiah, which seems a bit of an unfortunate name to me. They go to the comet and there's a number of little irksome things that aren't quite right to make that a little bit more exciting. Was there one thing in particular that bothered you around that?
Oh, where do I start? So they're landing on the comet, right? And they're like dodging giant blocks of ice, I guess, which I found kind of hard to believe. Comets do have this thing called a coma. So it's kind of the fuzzy blob around a comet. That's how you tell it's a comet. The coma is very characteristic of comets. That's why this newly discovered interstellar objects, if you haven't heard, there's a new object that came from another solar system that's now streaking through our solar system. Pretty sure it's a comet because it has this sort of fuzzy coma around it, as opposed to an asteroid, which is just rocky material. It's not going to sublimate that ice. It's not going to have that fuzzy coma. But this was a comet, and so it had the coma surrounding it. Typically, though, the material in the coma is very small, smaller than millimeter size. So you wouldn't have to be dodging house-sized ice chunks to get to the surface. That's pretty unusual. I mean, maybe you'll get the odd large fragment in the coma, but they're very rare. And so it shouldn't have been as dangerous as they made it out to be. I know, movie magic, right? They want to make it tense and interesting, but that was pretty unrealistic.
Yeah, the relative speed is too high. The size of the objects is too big. The fact that they show it as if you're in some kind of a really intense snowstorm, foggy type thing, the optical depth, as we would call it professionally, you know, how much of that stuff is obscuring your view. There's way too much of that as well. And the coma itself is way too small. I mean, it looks kind of like you have this material streaking off of the comet as if it itself in kind of a windstorm. But this stuff comes off fairly sedately, fairly quietly, and it can build the coma up to some really huge sizes. We've had comets in the last couple of decades where the coma is as big as the sun in terms of the actual size of the thing. This struck me as a little bit unrealistic as well, the way that it was depicted, but you're right. It does make it look more dramatic and menacing.
That's right. And then they land on the comet, which is a very, very hard thing to do because comets basically have no gravity. They do try to, I think, address this by including tethers on their spacecraft. So there has been one spacecraft that's landed on a comet, and it unfortunately did so badly. This was the Philae lander, which was associated with the European Space Agency's Rosetta mission to a comet I cannot pronounce. Do you know, can you pronounce that comet's name?
Let's go with CG.
Yeah, 67P CG. It has a very long Russian name that I unfortunately cannot pronounce. They landed on this comet with Philae, but I'm pretty sure Philae, it had tethers, right? To try to help it land, but
harpoons.
But it did it tip over and landed in a shadow and they weren't able to communicate with it anymore?
Just tumbled around because those harpoons did not go into the ice. The ice was too hard. Just ended up bouncing around and tumbling. And like you say, it went to a place which made it difficult for it to get power.
So that's humanity's one attempt to land on a comet, and it didn't go well. They make it seem rather easy to do so. And the astronauts look more like they're moving around on the moon, which has 1/6 Earth's gravity, which is much, much higher than you would find on a comet. And so that whole area was pretty unrealistic. Basically, you just have to be tethered, almost like an astronaut doing an extravehicular activity if you're on a comet. I also thought it was funny that they were trying to jump on a bomb to shove it down into the well. I don't even know how you would jump on something with zero gravity, right? Gravity is not going to help you impart any force to this bomb. So that seemed like a weird choice. I think people just don't really understand how little gravity there is on a comet and how hard it is to move around in such low gravity.
Gravity in general, they did not do a great job of. And what's, I think, interesting in this one is they give enough information that we can actually calculate the surface gravity on the comet. And it's 1/10,000th of what we have here on the Earth. Very, very small. With that jumping on the bomb, which, you know, feels like this movie's Armageddon moment, really. All he had to do was to, you know, brace himself on like the side of the wall or something. But no, we're jumping up and down.
Yeah. And then they make a point that this comet is rotating, which is fine. Comets rotate. And they land on the dark side. They don't have to deal with sublimation, which is also fine. That makes sense. But then as soon as the sun like rises over the horizon, so they take a little bit longer than they mean to on the comet. And they're like, get out of there, right? The sun's going to rise. And as soon as the sun rises, there's explosions and massive outgassing immediately. Comets do have jets of material coming out of them. But my understanding is most of it is just sort of like sublimation of the material. So it's not this explosive process. And certainly it wouldn't happen immediately upon sunrise because ice does have what we call thermal inertia, right? It takes some time for the heat of the sun to heat up the ice and cause it to sublimate. So you'd have a little bit more time there. Again, not as dramatic, but also not very realistic.
Yeah, I think the forces in general around the comet, they have trouble with, like trouble with the gravity. There's trouble with the amount of hydrodynamic force that you get from these jets. They should be very gentle. Even with a parachute, they wouldn't pick you up and do anything to you. And just thinking about how they navigate around the comet, you know, with the engines, there's this really climactic scene where it's, you know, oh, we've got to go and save the astronauts. And they're like, okay, we're going to fire the rocket thruster and we're going to fire it until we get to the bare minimum of fuel. And of course, me, space engineer here, is thinking, so you don't want to stop, you know, when you get there and null out all of that velocity you just gave yourself? I don't know. This seems to be like one blind spot.
Oh, speaking of blind spots, you got to make sure you have your visor down when you're in space. Otherwise, you will get boils on your face, apparently, which I found hard to believe. I mean, yes, PSA, do not stare at the sun. But as we'll talk about in a second, they were just as far from the sun as we are on Earth. So you would have to stare at the sun for quite a long time to go blind. Again, do not stare at the sun. It's a bad idea. But if you happen to for a second, you will not go blind. Nor will your face get instantly burned and have boils all over it. So that was kind of a weird choice they made. I guess they just wanted to make it more dramatic with the astronauts getting injured. It was kind of laughably bad.
Just like the worst science that we've looked at in many of these movies, it's something that has a kernel of truth, but it's been taken to a place where it doesn't make sense. Like if you were to take the helmet off and look at the sun with the UVC radiation that gets filtered out by our atmosphere, then you probably could hurt yourself pretty badly. I mean, the taking off the helmet in space is
you have other problems.
Your biggest problems.
Yeah.
Oh, definitely, definitely. But the actual suits, I found it interesting that the gold insert that comes down, that gets described even by NASA as this is helpful to protect against thermal radiation from the sun and UV, but the underlying visor, the clear part, is actually polycarbonate, which is one of the most UV opaque plastics out there.
Plastic is like the Earth's atmosphere and would protect you from most of the stuff. And the visor is more like sunglasses. Right? So it's a good idea to wear sunglasses, but you're not going to go blind if you don't. And you're not going to burn yourself horribly if you don't. That was kind of a strange choice they made, especially since it turns out they're very close to the Earth. So basically, the amount of solar radiation they're getting is almost identical to what we would get from the Earth. And this, I thought, was weird as well. So they make this point that the comet is 20 light seconds away when they're doing this maneuver. Now, I don't know if that meant 20 light seconds one way or 20 light seconds round trip. But in either case, it is very close to the Earth. To give you some context, the moon is one light second away. So we're talking like 20 moon distances away, which sounds like a lot, but in the solar system, it's not actually. So the distance between the Earth and the sun is called one astronomical unit, and 20 moon distances is 0.04 astronomical units. So we're like 5% of the way to the sun. We're basically at Earth. So they're very close to Earth when this action all takes place. I thought it was weird it took them 5 months to get there, since it should take you about 5 months to get to Mars, and that's a full astronomical unit away, especially with this fancy nuclear engine they had. To give you some context, it took 4 days for Apollo 11 to get to the moon with much smaller rockets. So even with like a small rocket like Apollo 11 had, it should only take 80 days or 2.5 months. To get to this position. Again, I don't know why they told us the distance. They could have just left that out. And then we could have just extrapolated, you know, how far we thought they could get in 5 months.
I can give them a little bit of a pass here, because sometimes you have to take some really weird trajectories to catch up to something just right. But you're right. The fact that they give some numbers here is not ideal. And it also bothered me, the whole communications blackout business. Like, you shouldn't have a communications blackout when you're, you know, getting close to a comet. There's just not enough stuff. There's not enough ions to block things, especially since this comet apparently didn't have an ion tail like comets usually have. And then the fact that they can't actually contact the Earth until they're like a day or two out, or not even that far. It was very close to the end. Mm-hmm. They couldn't contact the Earth. We have deep space probes like the Galileo probe, which visited Jupiter, whose big antennas failed entirely, and they communicated back to Earth with these really paltry omnidirectional cell phone like things. If you point a big enough radio antenna at something, you can talk to it. Maybe not fast, but you can talk to it.
Yeah, that was a good point you made. I'm not sure, again, why they did that other than for drama. And it's something you see in a lot of these movies, right? I mean, there are legitimate reasons why you might have a communications blackout. Like when the astronauts went around the far side of the moon, got an entire planet between you and Earth, it's hard to communicate. So there are some reasons that that might happen. But as John points out, there's no good reason why that would happen in this situation.
I want to sort of continue to follow the comet and jump ahead, because I think that very last bit, there's some real red meat for both of us.
Oh,
there's some atmospheric stuff. And, you know, for you, we've got an actual impact. Why don't we start? It's called Deep Impact. What did you think of the impact? You know, was it of the appropriate depth?
Backing up a second. So the astronauts, they try to put a nuclear bomb on this comet to blast it into smithereens before it hits the Earth, which A, is probably not a good approach to begin with, but B, it fails. They end up splitting this 7 mile wide comet into a 6 mile wide piece and a 1 mile wide piece, essentially. And now they're both coming to hit the Earth, which is bad. And it turns out that the smaller one, which they called Biedermann, because he was the kid who discovered the comet, so he's smaller than the adult who discovered the comet. I assume that's why they did it that way. So we've got the little Biedermann half of the comet coming to hit the Earth. And this thing is still massive. It's a mile wide. I mean, this is going to release 1.5 million megatons of energy. We talked, I think, about nuclear bombs in our Battlestar Galactica episode. This would be so many nuclear bombs going off all at once. And they do make the point that there's going to be a large tsunami that's created because this thing hits the Atlantic Ocean just off the coast of North Carolina. So that's true. You would have a pretty big tidal wave generated by this impact. But they kind of underestimated the rest of the effects of this impact. Not only would you get a large tsunami, you'd also have a large earthquake that would hit shortly after impact. You would have an airburst that could collapse buildings, and then the tsunami would arrive later. They are all racing to get away from the tsunami, which, again, was not terribly realistic, but you'd also be knocked down by the airburst, the earthquake would cause damage, and depending on how close you are to the impact, things might even set on fire. It would be bad news bears, and they didn't really depict any of that except for the tsunami.
Well, I've got worse news for the big fragment. From an atmospheric perspective. So the way that this is handled in the movie is that the Messiah manages to go ahead and blow this into lots of little pieces that they fly into a crack at the end. Again, a little Armageddon-y. And then what happens is, as we learn later, according to the president, Morgan Freeman, that because it was blown into so many little pieces, they all just burned up spectacularly in the atmosphere and gave us fireworks for a couple of hours. I'm unfortunately here to say, those are bad fireworks. And the reason for that is it's actually kind of worse in some respects to have a lot of little dust and pebble-sized particles entering the atmosphere instead of one big chunk. Don't get me wrong. One big chunk is a very bad
day. Yeah, the dinosaurs would have a quibble with you, John.
Absolutely. But here's the thing. That much material moving that quickly, you're talking about enough material to increase the temperature of the atmosphere around the entire world by 10 degrees Celsius. And you're probably not having it encounter the entire atmosphere of the world. You're probably having it, you know, encounter a very small portion of that. And depending upon how you play with this, and yes, I did do the calculation, dear listener, you could have temperatures in the atmosphere increase by 1,000 or even 10,000 degrees Celsius, which would just start lighting everything on fire. So you've got Elijah Wood, Biederman, with his child bride up on top of the mountain, that might be the end for them. In fact, it probably was, unfortunately.
If they weren't already knocked over by the airburst and fires that resulted from the first impact.
Exactly.
Yeah. Although, to be fair, you were probably going to get fires either way. A 6-mile comet is probably what hit the Earth 65 million years ago when the dinosaurs all went extinct. That's the large extinction event that occurred. They talk about these extinction level events. I would say, yeah, the 6-mile wide impactor that hit Earth 65 million years ago was the last big one. This is very much just ripping off what happened to the dinosaurs. And there is some thought that one of the major results of that impact was global fires from that impact. So I think you're getting fires no matter what, unless you can like deflect the comet much earlier than they did. That's our best bet. And we'll talk about that. I don't know if that's a science shine or a science gripe, but it is certainly possible to deflect asteroids and comets. You just need more time than they had in this movie.
Yeah, I think there might be a little bit of that when we talked about the science shine. Perhaps what we should do, though we have more comments, we'll just leave it here, dear listener. We'll take a short break and we'll be back with the science shine in just a minute. Welcome back. You did hear a lot of science gripes, and I like to think that that's because this is a movie that it shows its calculations and its work, and so we are able to criticize it that much harder. But definitely, there's some nice science shine here, places where we can talk about how they got it right. What really stood out to you, Catherine?
Overall, this movie got the science pretty right. And they did have some actual science advisors to help with that. So I'm sure that helped. And one of those science advisors was actually Carolyn Shoemaker, who was listed. If you look really hard, you can see her name on the astronomer's email list as he's trying to send that note out. One of the emails is titled, I think, 101 Mir jokes, which is kind of funny. Mir was a former space station run by the Russians. And her name is also on the package that he's racing down the mountain to get to the Department of Planetary Sciences at the University of Arizona, Tucson, which is where John and I both got our PhDs. So that's a real place, although Carolyn Shoemaker never worked there. Minor quibble. And yeah, her story is actually pretty cool. She was married to another famous scientist, Jean Shoemaker, who is one of the early folks who advocated for impacts being found on Earth. So for a long time, people would find holes in the ground and they would just assume they were volcanoes because impacts are very rare and they tend to get weathered over really quickly on Earth. So there's a very famous crater in Arizona called Meteor Crater. And Jean Shoemaker, her husband, was one of the first to show that it was caused by an impact and not a volcano. And this really revolutionized our understanding of the planets, because prior to this, a lot of people thought all the holes in the moon were volcanoes and not impact craters. And now we know it's the opposite. Impact cratering is actually the most common geologic process in the solar system. It's just that on Earth, they tend to get modified more quickly quickly than on other planets. So Carolyn was Jean's wife. Her background is not in science. I think it was in history or something like that. But she got brought into the scientific community through her husband, and at the age of 51, decided to become an astronomer, which is pretty cool to kind of switch gears in midlife and try something new, and actually became a very proficient asteroid hunter. Her, along with her husband and other colleagues, discovered quite a few asteroids and comets over her lifetime. As of 2002, she died in 2021, so I don't know what the updated number was, but she discovered or co-discovered 32 comets and 500 asteroids, the most famous being Shoemaker-Levy 9, which impacted Jupiter in the early 90s. So she and her husband and their colleague David Levy discovered this fragmented comet that ended up hitting Jupiter and Jupiter's own Deep Impact movie, which I guess we never get to see all the Jupiter folks struggling with their impact. So it was cool to see an actual scientist represented in this movie and to have actual scientists on board as science advisors.
They even do a pretty decent job of how these things get named, I thought.
I guess you could quibble over this, but in general, I think what they did in this movie is legitimate. So basically, comets are named after the people who discovered them. And if two people discover them at the same time, either independently or as a team, they will use both of their names. Now, technically, I guess Leo Biederman discovered it, and then Dr. Wolf just confirmed. But, you know, they were working as a team. I think this is fair. They would both get credit for it. Or if two scientists find it independently, they'll also name it for both of them. Another comet Swift-Tuttle, was found by Lewis Swift, and then a few days later by Horace Parnell Tuttle, and then they both get their names attached to it. So it's pretty common to see comets with two names attached. I think you can have up to three names attached to a comet. That's more rare, I would say.
I think that really goes to the idea that there are a lot of people out there looking for something like this. That's what I think to us as professionals makes it a little weird, that we're led to believe early in the movie that this comet was seen by an amateur and then lost for a year and kept secret. It's just interesting, you know, I think the way that that gets done. But generally speaking, I think the physical parameters of the comet are done pretty well. The way that it's depicted on screen visually, maybe not the greatest with Messiah, but the rotation that it describes, totally reasonable. And I think both of us did the calculation because there's enough information given in the movie as to its size and its mass, what the density is. And the density actually turns out to be pretty darn good, between 600 and 700 kilograms per cubic meter, which is suggesting that there's some void space in there, for instance, because the density of ice is like 921 kilograms per cubic meter. The fact that they've got their size and their mass all coming together, that the rotation is right, there's a lot to be impressed about there.
Yeah, they did their math for sure, and probably having science advisors on board helped with that. The comet, it has the density of porous ice, essentially, which is what the density of comets we've discovered have. So that's legitimate. They say it has a 14-hour rotation period. That also is reasonable. We have measured rotation rates for 23 comets, and they range from 3 to 70 hours. And there are some comets that have 14-hour rotation periods. So this is very realistic. The parameters there all check out.
And the fact that it's a comet at all, right? You know, we're not here to adjudicate Armageddon, though we've mentioned it several times. An asteroid in the plane of the solar system, the size of Texas. We would know about that.
We would know about
it. A comet.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Like a comet of this size that's coming in, you know, the size of Manhattan or Mount Everest. It's coming in off the plane of the solar system. It's probably its first time in the inner solar system coming in from the Oort cloud. That's going to be moving fast. It's coming out of nowhere. This is a more likely thing for us to encounter.
That's right. I don't know if it was because of these movies or what, but about 20 years ago, people really did start taking what we call planetary defense very seriously and started allocating more time and resources to identifying potentially hazardous asteroids in our solar system. So suddenly there was a huge spike in the number of discoveries, and it's now thought that we know about 95% of any asteroid that is a kilometer or larger in our solar system. So we're not going to get caught off guard by an asteroid, or at least not a dinosaur-killing asteroid. But comets, yeah, as John said, could kind of come out of nowhere. So there's two large reservoirs of comets in our solar system. There's the Kuiper Belt, which is like an asteroid belt, but made of icy objects beyond the orbit of Neptune. And then much, much further out, there's the Oort cloud. A lot of these objects, we just don't know where they are because they're very faint, they're hard to see. And if they were nudged to the inner solar system, it would come in very fast because they're screaming in from the outer solar system, possibly on a weird orbit. So if anything's going to surprise us, it's going to be a comet and not an asteroid.
And there were definitely some good things about that asteroid, or sorry, my apologies, that comet when they visited. I mean, visually, there's a lot of stuff wrong with that encounter, but there are some elements that are right. I was delighted to see cometary jets because this is something that I studied in my PhD just a little bit. So seeing those and seeing the fact that the comet is depicted as this sort of asphalty, darkish kind of object rather than something that is like blindingly bright that you wake up to on a February morning or just took out of the freezer. That was really nice to see, I think.
Yeah, I always compare comets to that like sludgy snow pile that ends up in parking lots in March. And most of the snow is melted away and you just kind of have this pitch black pile of icy garbage. People are surprised by that. They hear comet, they think ice, it's bright. But comets are some of the darkest objects in our solar system, much, much darker than the moon or the earth. And it's only through careful stretching that they look as bright as they do. And I thought, yeah, it looked dark when they were landing on it, at least to my unaided eye.
A lot of these objects are surprisingly dark. Like you mentioned the moon a second ago. The moon is something that people look up at it in the sky and they think it's a very bright object. They see it appear white. But there's a fun experiment you can do because the moon's surface is actually fairly dark. Mm-hmm. It's much darker than the earth. And if you ever have the opportunity, sometimes the moon will rise at sunset as the sun is setting. So you get that full moon that's illuminated like that. And you can look at the moon as it's rising and the sun is setting next to something on the earth that's being looked at the same way. So for instance, like a brick wall or a cinder block or something like that. And you'll find that the two of them actually look about as bright as one another. It's a fun little Trump die there to have two very different, very distant objects illuminated in the same way by the same amount of light and see that the reflectivity is actually not that different.
Pretty fun. I'll have to try it. For the nerds in the audience, the brightest object in the solar system that we know about is Saturn's moon Enceladus, which basically reflects all the light that impinges on it. And that's because it's constantly jetting out fresh ice that gets plastered onto its surface. And so Enceladus does look like a bright ice cube. Most other objects in the solar system are much, much darker than that.
I just have to put in a plug for 2001: A Space Odyssey. In Arthur C. Clarke's book, they actually go out to Saturn. In the movie, they didn't have enough money, so they stopped at Jupiter. But one thing I love about that is you have Iapetus, which has carbon dioxide ice, again, continuously being replenished on its surface, but only on one side. So it is almost simultaneously the darkest and the brightest thing in the solar system. And, you know, in the book, it's described that, you know, maybe this is intelligence telling us something, this beacon. Fun with reflectivity of objects. Sorry to put us a little bit off track there.
Well, we're both big Saturn nerds. I love the Saturn system. So another thing, which I wasn't sure if it was a science gripe or a science shine, and I'm still not entirely clear, but they made this point that they were going to go into this bunker to wait out the 2 years of darkness that would happen after the impact. And so the idea here is that the impact would cause a lot of, well, ash and dust in the sky, but also it would cause a lot of wildfires, which would also cause a lot of ash and dust in the sky. And that would lead to ecosystem collapse because photosynthesis will eventually fail. Right? If the plants don't have light, they will die. I was like, 2 years seems really short. But I did find a presentation from a meeting held in 2021. This is a big meeting for geoscientists. It's called the American Geophysical Union. It's held every December, and it's a big meeting for people to present their results. And there was one presentation in 2021 that claimed that at least for the dinosaur killing impact, the Chicxulub impact 65 million years ago, which was of similar size, that they looked at some fossils and a particular outcrop and determined that it would take about 2 years for that much extinction to occur. This abstract was never published, so you have to be a bit cautious there, right? The gold standard in science is what's known as a peer-reviewed publication. You send out your paper into the world, other experts in your field will comment on it, and if they agree that it's good work, it will get published. Abstracts like the one at the American Geophysical Union are not peer-reviewed. Anyone can kind of say anything that they want, and so maybe the authors changed their mind afterwards and never published it. I don't know, but it is interesting that there is some, I guess, evidence that an impact of this size could cause about 2 years of darkness.
I don't know. I kind of feel like either way you cut it, that is a long time to be subsisting entirely on Ensure.
There were a lot of Ensure product placements in this. I keep noticing it, like in the kitchen where Tay Leone is talking to Morgan Freeman, they have Ensure. When she approaches the Secretary of the Treasury, they had a ton of Ensure, and then they're shipping it into the bunker. Ensure must have paid a whole lot of money to be in this movie.
Why does the Secretary of Transportation have it? He's not going to be part of this thing. He's going out to be on his boat with his family to die. Why did he bring an insurer for that? That doesn't sound like
That's
fun.
That's right. You want to bring the filet mignon, the caviar, right? If the world's going to end. The bigger problem, though, and a bit of a gripe, even if this is true, if you have 2 years of darkness, it's not like plants are just going to like pop back up, you know, immediately. I mean, I guess they're bringing seeds and whatnot, but if there's total ecosystem collapse, you have to bring the whole ecosystem with you, right? You don't have to just bring the seeds, you have to bring the bees and all the other plants and animals that allow you to grow food on the surface. They were perhaps a bit too optimistic that 2 years would be sufficient to hide out in their bunker with their insurer.
It is interesting. This is something that I think we have learned more about over time and that we've really started to understand. I've been enjoying, you know, my summer here reading a little bit of Gerard K. O'Neill, famous for imagining what life would be like in space stations and what farming would be like in those places. And there's a point in there where he talks about, oh, we're just going to bring the things that we like and all the things that annoy us, we're going to leave at home. We'll get rid of the bees and we'll get rid of the insects that we dislike, only ones that we like. And I'm here looking at that and thinking, well, your farming's not going to work very well if you have just completely sterile soil and seeds and all of this. So, I mean, you're right. You know, there's almost going to be this need to go out and pioneer plants and get the soil started again and everything after something of this kind of magnitude.
Really, you want to prevent it from happening to begin with. And fortunately, we have some ideas of how to do that. They didn't really address this in Deep Impact, and Armageddon also suffered from this problem. They just, you know, every problem is, the solution is nuclear bombs, but we do have a better idea of how to deflect objects. Basically, if you can get them soon enough, and with a comet, you know, you have limited time, you can just nudge them slightly to affect their orbit so they will just totally miss Earth in the first place. And there was actually a NASA mission to test out this idea called DART, the Double Asteroid Redirection Test. And they had a successful test of this idea in September of 2022. I mean, they weren't trying to push an object out of the path of Earth. As we said, we don't know of any asteroids that are on a collision course with Earth right now. But they went to a double asteroid and tried to see if they could nudge its moon out of its orbit a little bit, and were very successful. So they impacted the moon called Dimorphos September 26th, 2022, and were able to change its orbit by 32 minutes, which is much, much larger than they had hoped for. So it seems like, again, if we can just get to these objects soon enough, you can just give them a little bit of nudge and they will miss the Earth. You don't have to blow them up with bombs.
Oh, yeah. You're only talking about a couple of meters per second, potentially, you know, if you catch it early enough. I've even seen proposals out there where maybe you change the reflectivity and then you have photon pressure do it for the right kind of object found early enough. That's the key. It's time with this sort of thing.
Right. But the place you do want to use bombs is apparently your spacecraft. They proposed this idea of having a nuclear-powered spacecraft. Now, they were only 0.04 AU from Earth. I don't know why they needed this. But if you did need a nuclear-powered spacecraft, there was this idea called Orion that was proposed in the 50s and 60s to power a spacecraft by basically a series of atomic explosions behind the craft. And they started to do some research into this and some tests. I actually found a YouTube video, you should check it out, from 1959, where they were testing it, not with nuclear weapons, it was just explosives. But it worked pretty well. And so they were kind of making some moves to have these nuclear-powered spacecraft. But then in 1963, the UN passed the Partial Test Ban Treaty, which prohibited them from exploding nuclear bombs in space or near Earth or in the atmosphere. And it kind of put a kibosh, and they never came back to this design. But it was something people were thinking about.
It's true. It's just one of these things that perhaps I feel is not really that well handled in the film. So the Project Orion spacecraft, which probably would need to be quite a bit bigger than the one that we've seen to actually take that kind of force, was designed mostly for what we would call chase trajectories, where you sort of go along a straight line in the solar system and too bad, sun, you don't win today in your gravitational dominance. But they still take 5 months to get to the comet, right? Which, as we've already said, even with chemical rockets, seems a little bit weird. Instead, what this looks like to me, just glancing at it, is maybe you've got something like what we would call an ion drive today. So something like nuclear thermal propulsion, which is a totally different system. So it could be that these two got messed up a little bit or mixed up perhaps somewhere. Nuclear thermal propulsion is perhaps a little bit more achievable. It's definitely nicer on the people who are traveling on the spacecraft. But even though that part maybe was not perfect, I did like, and you saw this as well, Catherine, that they did a lot of staging, that they didn't take extra mass when they didn't need to. Mm-hmm. They left their big booster from the Earth behind when they went in. That is a very common type of strategy. We use it on rockets that are trying to get out of the Earth's gravity well. The Apollo missions did a great job of this. Catherine, as you pointed out, you have the command module and you have the lunar descent module that are separate from one another. And in fact, when the lunar module takes off from the moon, it leaves behind the rocket and the tanks and all of that. Exactly.
Yep.
This is nice. It's quite accurate as well. Maybe this is a good opportunity for us to go ahead and jump on to the part of the episode where we're seeing how is it of its time. And I think we might have a few examples here. You'll hear all about them when we return. Welcome back. We're about to do the of its time part where we talk about what actually situates this. You know, I think there's a few things that called out to me as this being a bit of a 90s movie. How about you? Did you think, were you fooled into thinking this was shot yesterday?
Oh, no, it was very much of the 90s, but I love the 90s, so I didn't really mind. This movie was filmed in the summer of 1997 into the fall, and then it came out May 8th, 1998. This was a big time for X-Files fans, because the lead character in this movie, Taya Leone, had married Mulder, David Duchovny, in May of 1997. I must have seen this movie just for that fact, just for pure curiosity. The X-Files does have that very 90s vibe to it. All of the computers are straight out of my high school classroom. Those giant CRT monitors, the floppy disks, the modems, the cell phones, they all look very much of their time. I don't know what web browser Taya Leone was using. Web window? I don't think it's real. Have you ever heard of that? I think it was just a fake web browser they were using. But I like that it already had internet ads, even in 1998. Although they all seem themed to her search somehow.
Yeah, I guess they just have her access just pegged. And you have that little thing, I find, with the ELE, right? The extinction level event. She just puts that into her search engine and bang, it's there, as if that's the only possible thing that collection of letters could stand for. And to me, that kind of suggests something that you see a lot in entertainment from like the late 90s and the early 2000s, the idea that everything on the web is knowable and known, and that, you know, you can just find information there and it's easy. Whereas now we know there's just so much stuff out there that to even understand a fraction of it is totally impossible.
But I do think the internet was better. I think it was easier to find what you were looking for in the 90s than it presently is, right? Now you type something in and you get pages of AI, garbage, sponsored ads, and like you have to really dig through. It's like finding a needle in a haystack. In the past, you could type something in like ELE and get some useful information. So maybe that's something we could reconsider going back to. Maybe something the 90s did better.
Different ways of organizing things, certainly.
Yeah. So as we mentioned, this was the summer of killer asteroid movies. Armageddon came out 2 months after this. This was a thing. I think a lot of movies came out in pairs back in the 90s. Like I remember there was A Bug's Life and Ants. There were a couple of like bug theme movies that also came out at the same time. I don't know why this happened. It seemed like the filmmakers were working independently of each other, but they both seem pretty successful. So I guess there was an audience for killer asteroid movies at the time.
Could have been a trend or something.
Yeah, I'm not sure why it was so popular, but yeah, they both did pretty well. Deep Impact ended up being the sixth highest grossing film of 1998. So, you know, not too shabby. It had a large opening weekend. It was actually the largest opening weekend for a female director until Twilight came out like a decade later. Yeah, it did pretty well.
That's pretty good. And it's interesting, I think, that it was something that had a very long run-up. Like people had been thinking about making a movie like this. I believe you found some details going back to the late 70s. I do wonder if some of this is just another studio realizing, you know, hey, this other group is creating this movie. we need something to compete with them, and just taking sort of the lowest common denominator there.
Yeah, I guess this was originally supposed to be directed by Steven Spielberg, which I hadn't realized. He does get, I think, an executive producer credit, but he'd been approached to do a movie adaptation of an Arthur C. Clarke book called The Hammer of God. Arthur C. Clarke does not get any credit for this, so the story must be significantly different from the book. I don't think I've read that book. But then Spielberg was busy doing another movie, and once they heard that Armageddon was coming out, they wanted to speed up the timeline. So they approached Mimi Leder to direct this film. And it was interesting to compare and contrast a female director like Mimi Leder with Michael Bay, who did Armageddon. I definitely feel like Deep Impact was more character focused as opposed to explosion focused, which is what Armageddon seemed to be. And overall, I would say it's the better movie. But I care more about characters and character development than action. So maybe that's my preference.
Yeah, it's an interesting disaster movie, right? And we were talking about this a little bit before we started putting on the microphones about how, okay, there's destruction in both movies. And there is that peril in both movies, like, you know, oh my goodness, this thing is going to kill us all. But Deep Impact spends half of its time actually considering the implications in a way that Armageddon just doesn't. Like, the first half of Deep Impact is, oh my goodness, it's going to kill us all. Maybe a bunch of astronauts will save us. Oh no, they didn't. And then the back half is like, what does this mean for people? How do they understand that? How do they deal with that? And we get examples of people dealing with that kind of psychological stress in very different ways. And that exploration is interesting.
One thing that I thought was a bit off-putting, and I don't know if it's of its time or just of this movie, but the whole child marriage subplot seemed kind of manipulative and gross, and I did not like it. Come with me, your 15-year-old boyfriend, and you just have to marry me, and then I'll save your life. I didn't love that. And I guess audiences didn't love it either, because they were supposed to have more scenes together, and after some initial previews, they scrapped them because they thought some of them were too inappropriate. I mean, they were young. Like, these were teenage actors, and you could tell, and it just seemed wrong somehow.
Oh, yeah. And I guess you can imagine how this started, right? As they're putting the plot together and thinking, you know, like, oh, we need a way to get this character into the limestone cave with all the insurer. Let's go ahead and get them married. And then as they put it together, it's like, no, this does not work. And like you say, the test audience has said this does not work. And we're watching it today and we're like, no, Elijah, no more rings.
No more rings. Yeah, you'll have those in a few years. The other thing I thought was interesting was the fact that they made a big point of, you know, the network that Taylor works for is MSNBC and not maybe a bigger network like CNN. I guess they originally approached CNN, but they didn't think it was appropriate for them to be involved. But MSNBC had just started. I guess it didn't launch until 1996. So this was a brand new network. And I guess they just wanted the free advertising, so they got involved.
And forward-looking too, right? Because MSNBC is sort of a combination of, you know, your classic media company and also a very internet-focused company. And, you know, I think that goes with the vibe a little bit.
Yeah,
you know,
in
about
the end,
where people thought things were going.
Yeah, it's a good fit, I think, in the end. So I think MSNBC made the right call there. The other thing that a lot of people who grew up in the 90s would notice is any skyline from New York before 2001 is very distinct. I noticed this both in Armageddon, because they destroyed New York in both movies. Of course they did. Both skylines have the Twin Towers very prominently displayed, the World Trade Center that sadly was destroyed in 2001 by a terrorist attack. It really does put it of its time, any movie made before 2001. These Twin Towers are just so obvious in any New York skyline.
That really just absolutely situates it, right? And one thing that I think is interesting, you've got things that seem like they're outmoded at the time, like the child marriage. You've got things that are very of its time, like the skyline, but you also had some very central future-looking things on there. Morgan Freeman as the president was not the studio's first pick.
No, they're like, this isn't science fiction, which it is science fiction. We can't have a black president. That's crazy. And then yet a decade later, right, US elected Barack Obama as its president, and he served as president for 8 years. So yeah, it was very forward looking. And those producers were just racist, I think. Morgan Freeman is really one of the highlights of this movie. I was surprised to see the Netflix description. It only mentions Morgan Freeman. Their description is, Morgan Freeman's depiction of a calm, resolute president during a comic crisis is an undeniable highlight of this ensemble disaster film. That's how Netflix describes it. Nothing about the plot, just how amazing Morgan Freeman is, which, fair, you know, he is pretty amazing. I was trying to describe who he was to my children, because I'm like, what movie has he been in that they would see? And I'm like, you know that wizard guy from the Lego movie?
Oh my.
Has he been in any kids movies other than that? I couldn't think of any. But yeah, he does a really good job in this movie. The other thing that sort of is of its time, there was a NASA mission with exactly the same name as this movie. And I think it was just an accident. I think the names were determined independently. I haven't confirmed that with my colleagues, but that's what I could find through my research online. So there was a mission that was funded in 1999 called Deep Impact. And this was later launched into space in 2005. Space missions do take some time to prepare and get going, but it was designed around the same time this movie came out. And it eventually went to a comet Tempel 1, and hit it with an impactor. So it made its own deep impact on this comet. And this was a really important mission because it gave us some of our first really fine scale physical properties of a comet. We were talking about the density of a comet. Well, we learned a lot about that through this mission.
That's true.
And just how impacts form and the properties of comets are. So this was kind of a cool mission that had the same name as this movie that was being designed at the same time.
I think we probably have time for one more note. And the one I would pick out here is the shameless, shameless marketing done by the production company by creating a dangerous object in space just before this came out.
Yeah, I mean, I think that was probably an accident. As you'll notice in the news, we're always finding potentially hazardous asteroids that as their orbits get refined, we discover are not actually going to hit the Earth. But this happened back in 1997. There was an asteroid discovered, 1997 XF-11, that was about a mile across, and it was thought that it could impact the Earth in 2028. It was doing their marketing for them. Now, just after the movie's release, they got new images. As we said, you need more than one image to determine an orbit and determine that it will actually miss the Earth by 600,000 miles. So we're safe. Don't worry. As I said, we don't know of any asteroid that's going to hit the Earth, and we know about a lot of them. Yeah, it was kind of funny timing that this asteroid was discovered right before the movie came out.
Well, sometimes life imitates art. We're going to cap it here, and we'll be right back in just a minute with the ratings. So join us in just a couple.
This is the portion of the episode where we rate the movie in terms of its scientific accuracy, its influence, and how it holds up over time. We do this on a scale of 1 to 5, unless it's really bad. And then we might go below 1. But let's start with scientific accuracy. How would you rank this movie, John?
So despite the fact that we spent a lot of time talking science gripes, I think this one actually is pretty good. There's definitely a few big misses in there, but I'm going to call this one a 4.
I also gave it a 4. Overall, the science was good enough that it wasn't distracting to me. If the science is so bad, sometimes you can just distract you from the plot. Mm-hmm. But that wasn't the case here. We had some quibbles, we had some gripes, but honestly, I can find gripes in just about anything. Overall, I think they depicted the science pretty well and how people would react pretty well and the scientists pretty well. So not perfect, but 4 out of 5 seems fair for this movie.
That's a good criterion, I think, the distraction level that the science causes or the lack of science causes.
For my research, I also watched Armageddon prior to this podcast, and every other minute I was going, come on, that's not right. Come on. It was hard to watch. This was not hard to watch. I enjoyed this movie.
You need to disable your disbelief button on the back to watch Armageddon and enjoy it.
That's right. I think I enjoyed it more when I was 17 and saw it for the first time in theaters because I didn't know what I do now, whereas it was really hard to watch now as a professional planetary scientist. Okay, how about its influence? This can be on society, on you personally. How has it influenced you, John?
So this one is interesting, I think. I think going to mark this one down just a little bit. I did see it at the time. Remember it next to Armageddon as well. I'm going to give this one like a 1.5 because it doesn't seem like it has a cult following. It didn't influence me personally. At the time, even though it made a decent amount of money, it does sound like there were some people who felt that it was a little bit mild or not all that great. I think the influence this one has had is maybe a 1.5 type of area. But watching it again, I kind of feel like that's harsh. I feel like it deserves more than what I'm willing to give it on this one.
No, I agree. I gave it a 2 because I don't think it's had a huge influence. As I said, I remember Armageddon much better than this movie, even though this is a much, much better movie than Armageddon. I'm not sure why it doesn't get a lot of love. I didn't mention this, but I was doing some research and they were nominated for the 1998 Stinkers Bad Movie Awards, nominated for Worst Supporting Actress and Worst Screenplay for a film grossing more than $100 million, which I thought was harsh. I mean, watching it now, I really enjoyed it. Maybe it'll make a comeback. Maybe it'll get its own weird cult following. But if people have never heard about it, I don't know how that would work. But here you go. This is our recommendation to you, dear listener. Go out and watch Deep Impact. It's a pretty good flick.
Let's hope it does. It's definitely requires your brain an awful lot more than Armageddon does.
Yeah, yeah. And this was very much set in the 90s, as we talked about. How does it hold up in the year of our Lord 2025?
It's pretty good. There are always going to be things that situate it, but I feel like the things that they get right are the things that would still be right today. And the things that they get wrong would still be wrong today. I feel like it's not really moving in time other than just those things that situated in the 90s. So I'm going to go with a 4.
I put it at a 3.5 just because it is very clearly from the 90s. I mean, the hairstyles, the clothing they're wearing, the computers, the cell phones. It is a movie from the 90s. But, you know, in terms of the characters and the story and the science, that is all pretty timeless. So yeah, maybe a smidge higher than middle of the road for this one. All right, John, any final words?
I'm kind of wondering, what do you think would happen if we actually had one of these things that came by us in real life?
Chaos, probably. Morgan Freeman makes this big deal. Keep working. Life's going on. Water is going to cost the same tomorrow as it did yesterday. But I think people would just freak out and it would be lawlessness, basically. That's my guess.
That's true. But I think total extermination is probably unlikely. What do you think?
If there's a comet out there that gets nudged out of its orbit and comes out of nowhere with 2 years warning, I think we'd be in a tough spot. But don't worry. I don't actually think this is going to happen. It's extremely unlikely. Not to freak out all of our listeners.
This is good, but now I need to think of a third way to cue you up for the last line.
At any rate, I think life will go on. We will prevail. See you all next time.
Popcorn Science is hosted by Catherine Niche and John Moores, with Catherine taking the lead on pre-production, sourcing clips, and writing show notes, and John taking the lead on post-production and sound editing. Artwork for the show is provided by science illustrator Michelle Parsons, while Sean Nock handles web hosting and ensures that our conversations make their way to your favorite podcasting service.